Living Legends, sponsored by the New Farm Insider. I'm your host, John Reitman, and we had an opportunity recently to catch up with Ted Horton, who some of you might remember from his days at Winged Foot, Westchester Country Club, and Pebble Beach.
How does a kid from Quebec get to not just a place like Winged Foot, but Winged Foot and Westchester and Pebble Beach?
You know, while I was going to McDonald College, McGill University, agricultural biology, I was tracked towards a pre-med degree or veterinary science or wherever that was going to take me. But I worked on a golf course, which my parents belonged to, and they had sold the city course, the course closer into Montreal, bought a large piece of property out closer to where we lived, and were building 36 holes. Jeff Cornish was the golf course architect. And I just loved being outside. I'd always worked at camps or worked on home lawns and stuff like that. So I had an inside track and got a job on the grounds crew. The superintendent was a fellow by the name of Jim Hines, I think long since passed away. And the architect, as I mentioned, was Jeff Cornish. Jeff said, "Hey, Ted, you seem to really enjoy working out on the golf course." And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, you should consider continuing your education at University of Massachusetts in the turf grass management program. And I was very, very intrigued because I wasn't particularly happy with what I was learning and where I was headed. And I knew it was driving me inside, and I didn't want to go inside. So I applied for the University of Massachusetts when I finished at McGill, and unfortunately, because I was a Canadian citizen, I had to go through all the immigration status stuff. At that time, it was a little easier, I think, to get an immigration card. I wanted to get a green card or an immigration card so that I could work in the placement training programs and work up and down on the East Coast in particular. I wanted to see some southern grasses because I'd had no experiences in that matter. So that took about a year and a half in the process. I was working on courses. In the meantime, I traveled down to St. Petersburg, where my grandparents had a condominium, stayed there, got a job at a local golf course for a gentleman by the name of Reuben Hines. They had one of the LPGA tournament courses on that course, and I really enjoyed it. My sweetheart from grade 9 onwards, and I obviously stayed close in touch and ultimately got married during that summer. Went back and went to UMass. UMass had a placement training program. Somebody, and I'm probably our mentor, Joe Troll at UMass, said, "Hey, Ted, the most important thing is to work for a person who has a track record of getting young people jobs and training them well and really showing them all the ins and outs of the profession." I after interviewing several of individuals who probably would qualify as such in the Northeast, I was lucky enough to get a job with Sherwood Moore at Winged Foot. Now, this was an interesting story because Sherwood convinced me I should come back after finishing the two-year program at UMass and become his assistant. I had, during that year at school, Woodway Country Club had come to me and said, "Hey, we're thinking of retiring. Our superintendent is thinking of retiring. We'd like to hire a young person right out of school to come and work with him and kind of break in and take over when he retires." So I had that interview with a gentleman by the name of Harry Day, who was president of Woodway at the time, and that was impressive. I thought, "Gee, this is pretty exciting. I'm already tracked somewhere." And I went back, finished school, came on as assistant with Winged Foot. Woodway called me again for another interview. I went in for that interview, and the interviewing committee said to me, I remember this vividly, said, "Hey, Ted, what makes you think you can handle people? You've never done it." And I said, "You know what? I've watched the very best." Well, within weeks, they had interviewed and hired Sherwood. So I to this day, maintain that I got Sherwood his job at Woodway. So that being said, I'm at Winged Foot. I'm interviewing at the time with a couple of the clubs in that area, and very determined that I was ready, cocky young kid as usual, and the Green Chairman and the Search Committee Chairman, two individuals who I grew to love over the years, came along, and I was working in a drainage ditch to the left of the first green on the east course between second tee and first green, up to my ears in mud. And they said, "Hey, Ted, I hope you're not planning to leave now that Sherwood's leaving." And they had been interviewing superintendents all across the country, and so I didn't even consider that I didn't even apply for the job. And I said, "Well, you know, to be very honest with you, I have an interview coming up next week, and I think I'm ready, and so I'm not going to promise you I'm not going to leave." I came back into the shop. It was a Saturday morning, and Sherwood said, "Ted, go home and get changed. The search committee wants to talk to you and me, and at 12 noon." So I go home, change. I say to my wife, "I think Wingfoot's going to interview me." And so I go back for this interview, and it wasn't even an interview. And they said, "Okay, here's what we're going to start you at. Here are the conditions, and Sherwood is going to consult for a year, because Woodway was just a half an hour down the Hutchinson River or Merritt Parkway at that time." And so that was my start at 22, 23 years old at Wingfoot. I spent the 14 years at Wingfoot, went through the massacre at Wingfoot, the U.S. Women's Open in 72, the Men's Open in 74, and a multiple of other great events that Wingfoot is hosting. I always say that Wingfoot is probably one of the greatest golf clubs, and I very carefully call it a golf club. I mean, we shut down the pool. We had no tennis. Whenever there was a golf tournament, everything else had to just shut down and get out of the way. And so it was golf and golf alone. The membership at the time claimed that they had the lowest per capita handicap in the country. Whether that's true or not, I never researched. But it was golf, and I loved every minute of it, because it was just golf in its purest sense. And I had some great chair people there. One in particular was with me for my chairman for a long time. I thought about him, Wilson Barnes. Wilson Barnes used to say, "Ted, I want you to put three zeros on the end of every number you give me, because I want you to be thinking big, big, big all the time." And that was just wonderful experience. 14 years later, Joe Vincent, the new GM at Westchester Country Club, came to me and said, "Ted, they've run Westchester Country Club into the absolute ground. It is absolutely so close to being bankrupt, and they're giving me, the manager, a chance to anything I want to do, we'll do, and to save this club. Would you come on board?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm very, very happy at where I am. I have another Open coming up, the senior inaugural Open of the U.S. Senior Open." And I said, "Make me an offer." And he made me an offer which doubled my salary. At that point, I'm saying, "Gosh, you know, how do you leave Wingfoot? I'm happy. I've got these tournaments coming up. I've really enjoyed it. They've treated me very, very well." I'm sitting there. I had to get on the Hutchinson River Parkway for two exits from my house. I mean, not much more than a 10-minute drive. But I'm sitting there, and this is late October. It's getting cold, and my car had been sitting outside. So I get on the hutch. Get ready to get on the hutch. I step on the gas, and my car stalls halfway out in the middle of the parkway. And I said, "Holy cow! I can take a job at Westchester Country Club. Never get on a throughway again, and just drive down the side street to Westchester Country Club. Same distance, but no highways." I said, "The heck with this Hutchinson River Parkway. I'm your man, Joe." I later were talking with Armin Suni, who was a very close friend with Joe Vincent, and he said, "Ted, do you know that Joe offered you more money than he was making?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that, Armin." But I received calls with that offer from people all across the country, superintendents who I never had met in my life, saying, "Hey, Ted, you don't know me, but I just got a raise because of your move." And mm-hmm. And so the ripples were all across the country with that particular glass ceiling breaker or whatever it was called, and we finally kind of made some numbers, and that was kind of nice. I loved my time at Westchester. One of the green chairmen I had there I had two only, almost the whole time, three actually. And the first chairman that I had said, "Hey, Ted, I want you to pay attention. If we come back and say such and such is going on at somewhere else, I just want you to get on a plane. I want you to get in a car. I want you to run down the street, whatever it may be. I want you to make sure that we're doing everything as well as the guy next to us." And so that was really eye-opening, because from then on, I really made sure that when I went to a conference, I didn't sit with the people I knew. Oh, yes, I did. I socialized with them. But I made sure that at least at two events, I walked into a complete group of strangers. I went and sat down at a table that I knew absolutely nobody at. And I would break the conversation by using the big names of Wingfoot and Westchester and get some sort of acceptance or belief, and I found I learned so much, because you can become so terribly sort of stuck in your own sort of situation if you don't kind of explore what's happening outside your world. And so so that was a very, very good guidance that I got from a green chair. But one of the first things we did at Westchester Country Club was we said, you know, there's got to be things are struggling here. There's got to be something new happening. They've got to see something new happening. So that was one of the very first clubs that officially went on and triplex mode every fairway, picking up clippings. It was the very first PGA tournament that had ever striped the fairways with a triplex striping. I can remember to this day sitting with the PGA Tour officials and negotiating with them, saying, you know, you just got to let us try this striping. You just don't know how it's going to be accepted on television. And they said, well, we don't want television to start dictating how the striping goes and all that sort of stuff. I said, let's try it. And so we tried it. And of course, no one's turned back since then. We had a Toro triplex made a sort of it was a trim mower more than it was a fairway mowing mower that we totally adapted. And I kind of picked that up from, again, one of the courses where I was doing it on a minor scale in New Jersey, Mountain Ridge. Tony Bufano had been experimenting with it, and my green chairman had come back and said, "You should see those fairways where they're triplex mowing. Go take a look at that." So within a year, we were triplexing all of Westchester Country Club's West Course fairways, and with that, I watched a predominantly Poa-Anya bent grass sort of fairway convert over to probably 90% bent grass, and just become great fairways, and that was kind of a miraculous thing. I got ran around the country giving my talks on the costs of triplex mowing, et cetera, and had articles in the golf course magazine and everything costing out that process. So that was kind of a good one. The fun thing at Wingfoot that I love to talk about is when you set up a tournament, the PGA Tour, the USGA Championships, and the PGA National Tournament have specifications that are virtually identical, all set up for the types of grasses that you're mowing and playing golf on. One of the specifications at that time was 6 inches of rough in a cool season grass, but no one had been able to, I think, achieve that, because what we always did in every tournament prior to the 1974 U.S. Open was you took a set of blitzers, which is with large reels that could accommodate high grasses, but you could never set them higher than 3 inches. So you mowed your rough at 3 inches, and then you gambled and said, okay, it's now time to stop. I'm going to grow into the 6 inches, and by the time the tour is here, or the tournament is here, in 2-3 weeks, it will be at 6 inches. Toro had just come out in 1972 or 3 with the 74-inch rotary, just a trim rotary, and we bought 6 of those, put 6-inch wheel brackets on it, and mowed the rough the fall before and the spring of the tournament at 6 inches. So that gave us time to take a look at where it was growing in nicely, where it was not growing in nicely, adjust, so that we had a rough that had been uniformly cut everywhere at 6 inches of rough. Now, that at 6 inches, cool season grasses lay down and they tangle and all that sort of stuff. But we legitimately were within the specs, and the US USJ was pretty excited about it because they'd never been able to present that, and so we had rough during the U.S. Open that honestly the players couldn't find their shoes, let alone their golf balls. So to prove that was very successful, all the tour tournaments changed their specs to 4 inches for the next year. So that I felt the superintendent kind of won in that particular case, and I was, as you can believe, quite proud of that. The other thing is, it was the first time that I think they'd been presented with greens rolling in the 13, 14 foot range. At that time, we were all cutting quarter inch, and we went out and bought a whole bunch of old bed knives. We shaved the backs of those bed knives off. There were no close cut bed knives available at that time. We had to change bed knives every mowing. Every day we changed them. So then we were mowing greens much lower than we could. And all of this took place because we got just the greatest turf growing weather that particular spring that you could possibly have.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, all these tournaments, I've been through enough of them to understand that that you're not in control. So we got great weather, and all of a sudden, we had greens that were just much faster than they were used to. I think we were one of the first clubs to also put the blocks on an old greens mowers and roll greens for the tournament and all that sort of stuff. So all of that kind of was happening and surprising the golfers big time.
Just concrete blocks.
Yeah, just concrete blocks. And it was really funny because Jack Nicklaus in those days used to come and play the golf course the year before and spend a week just kind of getting to know the golf course. And he rented a house right behind our maintenance area. His children were the same age as our two boys, and they played together. And so I got to walk around with Jack and watch him play the course and talk to him about things. And Jack is probably one of the greatest golfers, if not the greatest golfer that we've ever known in our generation. And it was just fun to talk to him. So I'm taking him out on the fifth hole. George Fazio was a good friend with Claude Harmon, our golf professional. George had been hired by the club to come in and make some minor adjustments. Tom Fazio, his nephew, was working with George at that time. So Tom and I are riding along behind these two old guys, both having won the Masters, and they're talking about the good old days and everything like that. And Tom and I are out there doing the work. So we had made an adjustment on the fifth hole, added a small bunker in front of the green, closed down the normal running area into the green, so that amount of maybe a 10-foot, 15-foot at maximum sort of space where you could bounce a ball in. So now I'm out on the fifth hole with Jack Nicklaus, and I'm very proudly showing him this, and we're standing out about 220 yards. Remember, this is the old persimmon wood days, three wood days. And Jack says, hey, watch this, Ted. And he dropped three balls, and he bounced all three balls in that 15-foot range, in that 15-foot entry. So he totally deflated me, and he got the biggest kick out of that. We got talking about mowing greens, and Jack was very opinionated on how greens should be mowed. I also, of course, had my opinions, and so we went back and forth on that. I walked around just inside the ropes, and Jack Nicklaus's first round of golf in 1974. Jack hit it 20 feet past the pin on the first hole, stood over the putt the way only Jack Nicklaus can stand over a putt, and then knocked it 30 feet past the pin off the green. And I kind of said, okay, there's my comeuppance, my chance to come back at Jack. So I felt we kind of came away from that match a little bit even between he and I. So that was kind of fun. From Wingfoot, I went on and applied to be the general. From Westchester, I went on and applied to be the general manager at Westchester. I had been director of sports and grounds for 12 years, and in essence had an office up in the clubhouse. Was an assistant manager in essence, and thought, okay, let's go into management. But the more and more that I was up there, I realized that the people that I had grown to love out on the golf course, where they were happiest, were not the same people when they'd come in and had a drink or two, and it was not as much fun at all. And the manager's job was just not a pleasant job. But I thought I wanted it. I applied for it. I had one of the very good application, had a great interview. And the search firm at the time said, Ted, you know, your application was the best we've ever seen and everything like that, but we just can't picture a golf course superintendent being the general manager. That those were the days. And I was kind of crushed by that. So I went out and said, okay, then I'm out of here. And I went to work with a company, U.S. Golf Properties, that owned 13 properties between Pennsylvania and northern Florida. And I had a small vested interest, and I thought, okay, this is a way to grow. I thought that management, multi-course companies, multi-course management was probably a new thing to come and probably was going to really, really hit the country would by storm, and it did, but I didn't get to really participate in it too much. About a year and a half later, KSL came in and bought us out and became KSL East, and I was looking for a job. I got a call almost that day from Tom Fazio, said, hey, Ted, would you be interested in talking to Pebble Beach? They're looking. And I said, yes, timing's perfect. I would love to. So I went out there and was hired as their director of operations, in charge of all five golf courses and that program. And then within 3 months, the president came to me and said, Ted, I've been looking for somebody that I'd love to tie everything that we do outside, including our roads operations, our beach operations, our landscaping operations, our forest operations, and everything into under one person. Would you consider doing that? And I'd give you, and you'd become the vice president. And I said, yes, I would do that. So that was a great opportunity. The exciting thing about Pebble Beach is it was far more than just growing grass and maintaining the golf courses. The forest operations were so significant. Remember that the Monterey pine is the most prolifically grown tree in the world. I mean, there are hectare after hectare of Monterey pine grown in Chile, New Zealand, Argentina, and this is the largest commercialized lumber tree. And the whole genetic pool is in the Monterey Forest, a very small forest of which Pebble Beach owns most of. So now along comes this disease that attacks the Monterey pine, and we had a little nursery, and I had a very entrepreneurial young man who was the our greenhouse manager and managing all of the seed collection programs and all of the native plant programs that we had in place. And I said to him, Bud, why don't you take, we've got 10,000 little Monterey pines here. Let's call UC Davis and UC Berkeley, and let's see if we can get an inoculum of this particular disease, and let's inoculate all 10,000. I don't want to plant them now because we don't know whether they're going to live or not with this disease that's going on, because apparently this disease is going to affect 99% of the pines in our forest. Because it's so prolifically a growing tree and will recover so quickly, the forest will recover very quickly. But I want to make sure that we always and only plant trees that are going to survive. So we did that. We found the 99% or the 1% resistance, and we took those particular trees and realized that we could clone them. So now we had scientists from all these major tree farms from all over the world all coming and knocking on our door to see what's going on with the genetics of the Monterey pine, because these guys had billions of dollars invested in their forests and everything like that. We're just kind of having fun. So that was just, I think, one of the more exciting things. The other real exciting thing at Pebble Beach is that the president came up and said, I got two real challenges that have really been bugging us for years. We've got a seawall on the 18th hole that is just an old concrete block wall, and it is absolutely worn through, and one episodic event could knock that wall down, and the 18th fairway could be out in the ocean in a heartbeat. And he said, and we've been trying to get a new seawall permitted, and the Coastal Commission has come in and said, I'm sorry, we will not permit a seawall on a golf course. That seawalls are only permitted to protect structures, and structures are homes, buildings, schools, apartments, stuff like that, but not golf courses. We want the coast to erode. That's where our sand comes from. I'm sorry, you're just not.
Yeah, you're getting ahead of me now, because that's one of the questions I had further down my list. But that's okay.
Okay. Should I keep going or not?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm wound up. Don't get in the way. So my wife and I and the kids are visiting my brother in Calgary, and we go to a zoo that specializes in dinosaurs. And as a kid, I'd spent some time there riding our horses around and picking up dinosaur teeth and all this sort of stuff. Well, in this dinosaur zoo, every dinosaur is sitting on a beautiful big rock. But you go over there and you knock on this rock, and it's hollow and it's absolutely fake. But you wouldn't know it to look at it. So I went back and we hired an engineering firm, and I said, couldn't we develop a seawall that absolutely mimics the look of the normal rocks in the Pebble Beach area in that particular part of the coastline, and yet build it with the integral strength of steel and concrete and all that sort of stuff. And they said, sure, of course we could. And then they did it with a simulated mock-up like that, and we took that and presented it to the Coastal Commission, and they said, my gosh, if you do that, that'll become the standard for seawalls on the California coastline. And we did, and it is the standard for seawalls on the California coastline. So I was very, very proud of that. I can go on forever.
Oh, no, I understand. Now, I want to backtrack for just a second. When you go, when you mentioned when you went to Westchester, how things had deteriorated a little bit. And could you paint a picture for us of what things were like when you got there and what you did to whip the place back into shape?
Well, I want to be kind of careful, because I'd be stepping on toes and criticizing some of those who went before me. But their finances were just in such terrible shape. Their membership had eroded considerably, and their infrastructure was just so massive that it just getting old, that it just needed so much work that they weren't capable of coming up with the numbers to do it. And in particular, during my interview, the general manager said, "Ted, come on, I want to show you something." Had me put on hip waders, and we went downstairs into the basement of the clubhouse hotel, the old Biltmore Hotel, and we walked down there, and there's 3 feet of water in the entire basement of that particular property. And obviously the infrastructure was, you know, deteriorating terribly because of that. They had to deal with this massive plumbing and drainage system that had just was totally failing. The boilers were jeopardized. Everything was going. So that was just true throughout the property, including the golf course, the irrigation system. The maintenance area was falling apart. The irrigation system was an old cast iron and asbestos cement system that had not been automated or updated in the least. The equipment was in sorry shape. And general manager Joe Vincent, who was just an absolute ball to work with. I mean, he just completely changed his staff. He hired a new controller, a new chef, and myself, and we were the four sort of magicians who were supposed to come in and do it all with the team. And we just had a great time, because as we made some changes, money started to flow. It's just such a massive, big property that the numbers make sense, and there was no, I don't want to say there was pilferage going on, but there was pilferage going on. And once all of that was kind of dealt with, the money was there to do the right thing. And immediately we changed our mowing practices on the golf course. There was immediately a sense that something new was happening out on that golf course. We had Jeff Cornish in as part of the Triplex mowing to come in and contour the fairways, which made it a very, very tight and you know, added to the difficulty of playability for that particular course. We negotiated with the PGA Tour, and this is a fun story, and I call it sort of planning for success or scheduling for success. They had my first PGA Tour event. It was the Westchester Classic in those days, then to become the Buick Classic, and was held in August. And August in New York area is really iffy for successful tournament preparation. So I convinced our, having gone through a U.S. Open in June in that area, I convinced our club that we've got to sit down and change the date of our tournament if we're going to be successful at this tournament, or going to be guaranteed success. And so the club set up an appointment with, at that time, Bill Jennings, who was the tournament chairman, the owner of the New York Rangers, Dean Beeman, PGA Tour at the time, and I met with those two individuals at a hockey game. My wife and I went down. We sat through the first period of the hockey game, and then I went up into a meeting room and sat down with the two of them. And I'll never forget, again, this Bill Jennings, and I'm giving my spiel about why we've got to move from August to June, and Bill Jennings is looking off to the left wall, and I'm saying, he's not listening to me, he's not hearing me, he's not looking me in the eyes, I'm not getting anywhere here, and it turns out he was totally deaf in one ear and always turned his head to listen more carefully. Mm-hmm. Well, sure enough, within 6 months we had changed the date of our tournament, and from then on our tournament was the tournament just before the U.S. Open in June. And again, I was very pleased to hear David Fay on a recent, probably a year ago, commentary during a U.S. Open saying, you know, Westchester Country Club changed their tournament date and often out-opened the Open because of it. And I thought, wow, he really got it, because that's exactly what our goal was. So with that idea, we were able to always make sure that the foreign players were in town to tune up for a U.S. Open. They knew they were going to have conditions very similar to Open conditions, and our tournament became much more successful for years to come. So that was kind of fun.
To have someone of that caliber say that you out-opened the Open had to be give you quite a sense of accomplishment.
Yeah, it did. It did. And I knew David Fay. I mean, I'd worked with him through USGA events and everything like that. And yes, I was very complimented. I was thrilled. That was the goal.
Now,
with that, I have to, you can never pretend that say, the superintendent can take all the credit for any of those things, because clearly I had a very supportive, you know, board of directors and management and everything like that, and all of them kind of on board with this whole thing. I mean, it was a fun team for quite a while there.
Yeah, sure. Any level of achievement is typically a team accomplishment.
Yeah.
We'll be right back after a brief message from our sponsor. We're back on Living Legends with Ted Horton.
Now, when you were growing up and working on a golf course, did you play golf as a youngster?
My parents played. My mother played a lot of golf. She was a had been the women's club champion. She was their ladies captain, so she was very, very much involved. My dad worked hard and was very successful in his work. He didn't play as much or as well. My parents did go out and play on the weekend together on occasion, and I did go. My brother and I did go out with them and play. My mother and father always said to me, Ted, please, there are two things we want you to do: play bridge and learn to play golf. You'll be able to do those. Both of those the rest of your life. Forget the skiing, forget the hockey, forget the football, forget the baseball. Golf and bridge will be available to you all your life. And of course, as a young man, I didn't listen. So yes, I played. I certainly had all the basics and the ground rules for golf. I liked to hit the ball like any kid. I didn't like or enjoy the amount of time it took.
Did you play bridge?
I never played bridge. I never have. No, and yet, as I've gotten older, I realize how right they were.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it isn't.
When you look back at the places you've worked, I mean, it's a dream job of locations. You know, I was looking over your resume and just your
your different accreditations, the groups that you're in, the awards you've won, all the sort of peripheral stuff takes up more room on your resume than your actual your experiences and career objectives and things like that. So, you know, that's, but it, I guess the real question is, Warren, when I look at some of those things and all the things that you're still involved in and have been for decades, where the heck did you ever find time to even grow grass?
You know, I had terrific people that worked with me, and I think I gave them the tools to carry on and do it, and probably they could do it better than I could. I think I was very good at recognizing where my strengths were and where my weaknesses were. I think one of my strengths was to hire good people and be sure that no one gets in their way, and I spent most of my time, you know, in that fashion. One of the things that I'm probably proudest of my resume, and I remember you writing an article about retirement and what to do after 50 type of thing, and I long ago again, when I had that brief stint with a multi-course company, I'm saying, you know what, superintendents have got to start having a better rapport with the owners of courses, with the managers of courses, with our bosses. We are somewhat of an introverted group of people. We love to be alone and out of doors and out of sight and out of mind and all those sort of things. We're behind the scenes almost all the time. But with that, we were the paid the least and on all of that. And yet we want to be recognized as the true professionals we are. And there's no question in my mind that we are the best trained of all three professionals in a club management system. And yet we were not rewarded with as we should be. So I'm saying, the only way I can do anything about that is making sure that I tell the story. And where do I have to tell the story? I don't have to tell it to fellow superintendents. I need to tell it to club managers. I need to tell it to golf course owners in particular. And with that, I think I've put a lot of focus of my time, probably very unrecognized by the balance of my profession, into basically reaching out to NGCOA, was a co-founder of CGCOA, became their executive director as a part-time job for 11 years, stayed involved in that.
For our listeners, you're talking about the California chapter of the Golf Course Owners Association.
That was an interesting story. There were a bunch of us at Pebble Beach sitting around bemoaning the fact that the California Bureau of Tourism had a book probably an inch thick, if not an inch and a half thick, of everything you could possibly do when you come as a tourist to California. Please call us. We'll send you the book. If you page through it, there was one advertisement for a golf course, period. And golf was just non-existent in California. And so we're sitting there begrudging this fact, complaining about our Bureau of Tourism and everything like that. And I said, you know what? Has anyone asked them about why this is this way? And we got a bunch of befuddled looks around the table. And I said, you know what? I'll get on a plane. I'll go up to Sacramento and we'll make an appointment. And one other young woman went up with me, a gal by the name of Lorelei Abels. And she was a very bright young woman. And I said, the two of us will go up there and we'll talk to them and find out what this is all about. And Lorelei had some tourism experience. She was from Orange County area and had been dealing with some of that from that perspective. So we fly up to Sacramento and we sit down with the individuals from the Bureau of Tourism. I've forgotten the names at this point, and say, you know, why would this book come out and not a mention of golf? And they said, well, all the tourism events are all self-sustained in this booklet. So we sent a note to golf saying, do you guys want to contribute and we'll get golf into this thing, just like we sent a note to the wine industry, just like we sent a note to the sports industries and all that sort of stuff. And I said, oh, And so no golf courses responded, and said, "Oh yes, just one." And it was, turns out to be Nick Lombardo from the Monterey area. And of course, he was at that meeting, and he never said a word. and everything. So we come back and say, "Guys, we've met the enemy. The enemy is us." And at which point we said, "You know, if we're going to accomplish anything here, we got to form our own Monterey golf course." Owners association and start making some noise. And at which point I said, you know what, why would we form a Monterey Golf Course Owners Association? No one else has claimed the California Golf Course Owners Association. All our rules and regulations, all our major clout is up in Sacramento. Why don't we call ourselves California? At which point we did. And that was at the time when Paul Porter was still alive, and he was at the NGCOA. Excuse me, not NGCA, the Northern California Golf Association, as their executive director. And Paul was a dynamic individual, and he said, "Wow, that makes a heck of a lot of sense. I'm in." And with that momentum, we pulled together SCGA, NCGA, and that was at a time when I honestly, as a Californian, and fairly new Californian, couldn't understand why in North and South were not really kind of, you know, working together as one big outfit. But there was really a Mason-Dixon line between the two of us, North and South, and that, I think that helped to pull both of those organizations together, and it became much stronger individual, stronger individually, and so we went up and started the California Golf Course Owners Association, affiliated with the NC, with the Northern Cal, excuse me, with NGCOA, and became a very viable chapter, and I went on to sort of manage it from an executive director's perspective for quite a while I was still at Pebble Beach, and then when I retired from Pebble and managed it on as a consultant. The other thing we were sitting around the table again saying, "Hey, you know, the superintendents, of course, I was fairly close with most of the superintendents, and they said, we want to do a survey of how much money is spent on golf course maintenance in golf." And I said, "You know what, at this point I'm getting very involved with the NGCOA. I'm getting to know the pros, I'm getting to know the managers, I'm getting to know the owners." And I said, "No one's ever done an economic analysis of golf in California. No one's ever done an economic analysis of golf, period." And I said, "You know, let me talk to our peers and see if they would go in with the superintendents. You guys have got some money ready to go and everything like that. Let me see if we can expand this and do a complete survey of or analysis of golf in California." And they gave me a couple of months to do that, and we were able to pull that off. And that became the first, I believe, the very, very first really scientifically done economic analysis of the value of golf in California. And that, of course, has leapt leaps and bounds to Golf 2020, which then did an economic analysis across the country by taking over this process and doing the same thing for a number of states. So that was the beginning of that process. I think the California Alliance for Golf then resulted from that success, and with that alliance, we nipped a tax on golf possibility in the bud and shut that down. We've also started a bunch of things. The interesting thing that we're working on now, and Mark Connerly, the executive director now of CGCOA, would be a great story for you, I think. He's working on a golf commission. I was appointed to the, while I was, I'm sorry if you're bouncing around, while I was at Pebble Beach, I was appointed to the UC Advisory's President's Commission for Agriculture. Now that was a very prestigious sort of appointment. That was the Harris from Harris Beef, the Gallo from Gallo Wineries, the, I mean, just past U.S. secretaries of agriculture, and you name it. UC system's the largest university system in the world, probably the, 10th or 14th largest economy in the world. I mean, just a tremendous thing. And we had 3 days twice a year with the UC president and key staff on in discussion. So I'm sitting at one of these meetings and I'm listening and I'm saying, okay, I'm in charge of the maintenance of all the grounds of Pebble Beach, a fairly prestigious resort and one of the greatest properties in California. And I'm listening to an avocado grower sitting beside me pounding on the table saying, I want to have a UC representative visit every one of our avocado farms once a week during growing season. And I'm saying, holy cow, I'm at some of the state's greatest golf courses, and I can't get a UC representative to come spend 10 minutes with me. They just aren't doing that. And I'm saying, how did you get this? And then after some study, I realized that the avocado had what they called a commission. That for every avocado that's sold, a penny goes into the pot. I don't know what the numbers are, but money is generated for every avocado sold, and that money is then at the commission's discretion for research, for assisting UC with other things, for advertising, for all of this kind of legal resources and everything. That, so they're extremely well funded, and with that money, they buy influence. And so I'm saying to myself, why can't golf do that? So we in California are in the process of trying to legislate, and it has to go through the legislature, a golf commission. That would might mean 10 cents a round or 10 cents or something. And again, I don't know what the numbers would ultimately end up being. We speculate all over the world with those numbers, but we're trying to tie together golf to start helping themselves, and it's virtually it's a very, very difficult thing because there's so many independent small golf courses and so many proud private clubs that don't think they need any help for anything, and it's a difficult one to overcome. We're really making headway. I really believe something like this could happen, if not throughout the total golf industry in California, then partially throughout it. But a great story for you is Lying in the Waiting with Mark Connerly.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were doing all this, getting involved with the owners throughout the state and pioneering the California Alliance for Golf, you were getting involved at levels then that superintendents just weren't involved in, or very few.
No.
Which and that's changed since then. Did you know at
yes,
the time that you were sort of becoming like a pioneer for others who would come behind you in your chosen field?
I think I was certainly hoping that others would come along behind. I first got involved in that in when I was at Westchester Country Club because of a very you do these things because there's a need for it, and you and your club can personally benefit. But in this particular case, the water company, because we were the largest user of potable water in Westchester County, the water company came along and shut us down one day, and because they'd had a major break in their water lines, totally unrelated to where we were, but they needed the water that we could possibly use, so they just independently came over and just closed a 24-inch main that went out to Westchester Country Club, and shut us down for a 2-day period. Well, that was 2 extremely hot days just prior to the very first Westchester Classic tournament that we were experiencing. So, boom, I lose more grass than I've lost in the whole 15 years of my career prior to that in 2 days with a major event coming up on national television. I'm personally embarrassed. I'm upset. I don't know what to do, and there's nothing I could do. So I went to the president of Westchester Country Club, and he said, you know what, the young woman who's the executive assistant to the Westchester forgotten what his title is, the head of the Westchester County government. And he said, I'll put an inquiry in. Well, pretty soon I'm sitting in front of this individual explaining my problem. And he said, you know, we have a drought emergency task force. Would you consider participating in that? And I said, of course I would. So I sat down at this first drought emergency task force meeting with vice presidents from some of the major corporations in Westchester County, vice presidents or presidents from some of the big banks, and I'm saying to myself, these guys don't know beans about water, and yet they're making decisions and ratifying what Westchester County staff are determining are the solutions. Well, turns out that I, as a golf course superintendent, had dealt with impounding water in our small storage ponds. I had pumps. I understood pumps. I understood what pressure was. I understood what a water flow and all that sort of stuff. All of a sudden, I'm chair of this drought emergency task force. And so from that point, clearly golf was far more represented and far, far better able to withstand drought emergencies. There were no instant shutoffs in that situation. So that was a real good learning lesson for me. And I say that because during my career, I often wonder, you know, am I doing the right thing? Am I using my strengths or weaknesses as well as I should be? Are there other things I should be doing? So I went down and took this battery of tests that illustrates what you could or could not do in the workforce if you were to look for a job and everything like that. And it turns out that golf course superintending just trains you in multiple things. You're dealing with people. You're dealing with equipment. You're dealing with time schedules. You're dealing with nature. You're dealing with all sorts of things. And it just gave me a tremendous confidence that holy cow, I'm as well trained as any of these guys who are making millions. I'm not making the millions, but I can stand up with them anytime.
Mm-hmm. Now, in some of our previous discussions, you've talked a lot about the impact that Joe Troll and Sherwood Moore have had on your career.
Yeah.
Can you,
yes,
for our listeners here, can you expand a little bit about that, about how each of those gentlemen affected your career?
Well, Joe would certainly have been first. I mean, he as I came in as a, you know, and of course I'd been through some schooling, and I was one of the older students in class, and I clearly knew what I was aiming for and what I wanted, and I had a wonderful wife who was going to make sure that I got there, so she's behind me all the way. So Joe I think recognized that and immediately embraced that, made sure that I was exposed to anyone who he felt would be beneficial to know. He carefully introduced me to any of the key people who came in to talk to the class and gave me the opportunity, because I had a little car, a little Volkswagen at the time, to pick up key people who were coming to speak to our turf class at the airport and stuff like that. So he gave me all those opportunities, in his great way with people, he was a great people person. He just made us kind of, I guess, better prepared to get out there and do what we had to do. He was always telling us, you know, the stories of the situations that where failure was imminent and stories where success was imminent, and encouraged us to emulate the successful stuff. So he clearly was a great mentor at the beginning of my career. Sherwood, I don't think there's ever been someone quite like Sherwood. At least I know in each area there is someone who stands out like that. And I mean, the Bob Williams in the Chicago area, the Sherwood Moore in the New York area, and some other key areas, the Maples family in the Southeast, and so on. But to me, Sherwood just took me by the hand and recognized that I wanted to succeed, and just threw me into the fire and made sure that I did. I'll never forget going to superintendent's meetings with him. I'll never forget trying to trying so hard to stand up at the bar and drink scotch the way he did. I hated this stuff, but I had to try and do it because Sherwood drank it. And I can remember driving to and from meetings and getting horribly lost 50 miles beyond where the meeting was. I mean, it was it just was. Sherwood was just one of a kind.
For better or worse, since you're still so involved in the business now as a consultant, and still active in several organizations, for better or worse, how has the superintendent industry changed since the time you entered the business?
I entered the business in an era of one of the very sort of first runs of college-trained superintendents. Prior to that, the training had been, you know, hands-on, growing up through the ranks into the job. So I was one of the very first to come out with the college training and into the job. Today, the college training is just far more sophisticated than we went through, and the demands for scientific knowledge and understanding of computers and understanding of all the capabilities of equipment are far greater than when I was involved. I think that the young people today all have assistants, two or three of them, all have office help. Not all, but it's become far more businesslike, and I think that was one of my biggest concerns and I won't call it complaint, but biggest cries for help to GCSA. I said you walk up and down the aisles of our seminars at GCSA, and everyone that in diseases is full, everyone in insects is full, everyone in fertility is full, and then you walk up and down into a safety seminar and there's five or six guys there, and you walk up and down into a business management seminar and there's five or six guys there. I said, we've got to, if we're going to be successful, we've got to understand that we have got to run this like a business. And to this day, I don't think we've totally gotten there, but it's gotten much better.
Right. If you were a college student now and working on a golf course over the summer, or a high school student working on a golf course over the summer, knowing what you know about the business now compared to what it was several decades ago, would you choose the same career path, and why or why not?
Would I choose the same career path? I can't remember a day when I wasn't happy in my job. So I would hope that I could find a career path very similar. I think I would train a little differently. I would make sure that I had a lot more business management training. I think that I'd be able to talk numbers far better than I can. I think I'd work very hard on being a better salesman, although I think I was, you know, pretty good at that, but I didn't have the special training that I know people can have, because every day you're trying to sell somebody on something. I don't know how to answer that question. I just hope for my children and for my grandchildren that they can be as happy in their work as I always was. I hope they don't have to work as hard, but I hope they just love every minute the way I did.
Now, your current work as a consultant, you know, a lot of times that title carries sort of a negative connotation for other superintendents who, when they find out that a consultant is coming in to look at conditions on a golf course, there's always that feeling of having to look over your shoulder. As a turf consultant and a former golf course superintendent, what do you see as your primary role when you are called upon to consult on a property?
You know, let me, before I kind of answer that, if I ever do, explain sort of what my consulting sort of business ended up being. I initially said, okay, I'm going to hang the shingle out, and yes, I'm going to go and work at any club that calls me and everything like that. But I found very quickly that, gosh, you've got to be selling your time. And as a one-horse show, you've got to be selling and then going out and doing the job. And I found that I'd sell myself onto a job, and I'd go out and do it. But while I was out there working my tail off doing the job, I wasn't selling. So I didn't like the up and down, the up and down and the up and down of that cycle. I was used to getting up and going to work every day and knowing where I was going. So I said to myself, I'm going to, and this is within a year of my consulting, I'm going to sell TED a little differently. I'm going to say, who wants to buy TED in quarters? And immediately the National Golf Course Owners Association came up and said, we'll buy half of you. And Valley Crest came along at the time and say, we'll buy a quarter. And so with that, I said, that's the end of selling. From then on, if a little tidbit comes along, that's where I fill that other quarter time if I want to fill it, or I start having some fun with my wife. She's put up with me for 50-odd years. Maybe we can do a little something together. And that's the way my consulting business has been ever since. And that's the way it, until very recently, probably within the last year or so, I've just kind of backed it down. I'm no longer, I'm just on the advisory board of CGCUA now. I'm not doing any work. Once a year or twice a year, I go in and I help the NGCUA with the top agronomic sort of group, which I helped to found years and years ago. And Valley Crest calls me sort of as needed, more as a mentor, more as a hey, do you know anyone over here type of thing. I'm no longer really running around like crazy like I was for them for a while. So my consulting was a little bit different. When I initially would get a call from a course and say, could you come and evaluate, I always said to them, please, does the superintendent know you're calling me? And if so, do you mind if I give him a call before I come onto the property? I don't want to surprise him in the least. And I said, if at all possible, I'd really appreciate a call from him and him or her. And that's the way I handled that situation. I never felt that I was going to jeopardize a superintendent. Now, obviously, if I got on property and the superintendent was an absolute numbskull and was just doing something really wrong, I was not going to support that. But I just didn't allow myself to get put into that position very often.
Now, through that position and a lot of your other work throughout the course of your career, you've done an awful lot to promote your profession, whether it be yourself or colleagues and those who have come up behind you. You've really paved the way to elevate the profession of the superintendent. Given that, if you had a platform to where you could talk to your colleagues about, okay, this is what I've done to pave a path of career development for myself and for colleagues, here are some words of wisdom I can impart on you, things that you can do to elevate the profession yourself. What would be some of those words of advice you'd give to other superintendents?
Well, I mentioned this already, but I think one of the more important things for me was don't keep looking, keep growing, keep exposing yourself to things that are changing. I mean, if you hear of a tournament that went extremely well in Baltimore and you're up in New York, figure out how to go down there and talk to the superintendent. He's going to talk to you, or he or she's going to talk to you. They're going to let you know what's going on. If you hear of someone who's mowing fairways a whole lot cleaner and better than you are, you go go look at it, and if at all possible, adapt it if it makes sense. And as I said, that the meetings that I went to and sat down as a complete stranger at a table where everyone else knew one another. I mean, the whole Chicago group would be sitting together, and I'd plunk myself down. The whole San Francisco group would be sitting together, and I'd plunk myself down. My wife and I, and my wife is a can make small talk like nobody else. I mean, she's just amazing at that. So she would break the ice. And I'd come lumbering along behind and gather in the fruit, we did that, you know. Well, we've been to conference for 50 odd years together, it's just very, very interesting to be able to learn from others, because everybody does it a little bit differently, and everyone does it a little differently in different locales. So, and one is probably better than the other. But if you don't get out and see it or learn about it, you stay stuck in your sort of present situation.
Now, you've mentioned your wife an awful lot here today. Well, let's give credit where credit's due. Tell us her name, how long you guys have been married, and how she's supported your career.
Yeah, my wife is Nancy. She and I met in high school in grade 9. We dated all through high school, all through college, and got married when we were 21 years old, and moved across the American border, Canadian border. Border the night of our marriage, and started our honeymoon by traipsing down to Florida so that I could work on southern grasses, and she's a brilliant student, was one of the highest accoladed student in McGill University, graduated with her degree in teaching, has gone on to get two other master's degrees, and is just remains an absolute pillar in the community. She's been the past mayor of our city. She's currently on the local water board in an elected official position in Los Angeles area, as I said, great in small talk, very well read, pores through the newspaper, puts the articles on my desk that she feels I should read because I'm too lazy to do my own research, we've been married for 52 years, two children. She's been an absolute pillar in my life, just as solid as a rock.
How important has that support network been to your success?
I don't see how anyone could accomplish half of what I think I've accomplished without that support. I mean, I don't know. I've never had to worry about home.
Well, Ted, thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate your time here today.
Thank you, John.